Well, all right, here's where I say it, folks. Turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins, or Parsha, and it's in the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, in the wilderness is the Hebrew meaning of that word. Chapter 19 starts at the beginning of the chapter, and after the introductory phrase that we see all over the place, which is common enough that it doesn't count for naming the Parsha, where it says, "And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe and unto Aaron, and here's what he said," then we get the quote that ought to be the words in red anyway, and I'm going to take a slight issue with most English translations, because it says Zot Chukat HaTorah. These are, not this is how it's translated, this is the statute of the law. Nope, it's these are the statutes. The Chukat word there, which is what the Torah portion is named for, is actually plural, of the Torah, which Yahuwah has commanded. And he said, "Speak unto the children of Israel, then that they bring unto you a red heifer without fault, wherein there is no blemish, and upon which never came a yoke." This is a heifer that's not been in bondage. Interesting. And then we're going to see a description of what it is that's going to happen, where she goes to Eleazar the priest, and what the process is here. But a couple of things up front about this portion and about this this statute, this thing which, by definition, folks, you probably have heard me talk about this enough, now you know the meaning of the word. A hook is one of those things which is basically just do it because I said so. It's a statute. It's not a mitzvah or a kind of a commandment, in other words, that we can look at like thou shalt not kill or thou shalt not steal and say, oh, I can kind of see the point in that. A hook is one of those things that is literally just, again, do it because I said so. It may not make any sense to us at all, and that's kind of what's really fascinating about it. Now, certainly, if you understand what the Midrash says and some of the comments that are attributed to Solomon and other folks, remember, Solomon was the wisest dude who ever walked the planet. He didn't get it. He says, this one really flummoxes me. How is this going to work out? What's the point of the red heifer? In the Hebrew, by the way, it's the parah aduma, the red heifer. And that's kind of how the portion is framed. It's named for this really interesting and kind of enigmatic thing, an enigma wrapped in a riddle. There's been lots written about it over time. But what is in particular fascinating about this whole portion is that it has these enigmatic elements, and perhaps the most enigmatic of the whole bunch is the fact we're going to see the death of two of the three primary figures in the entire Torah, at least in the Exodus portion of the Torah, and that would be not Moshe yet, but Miriam, his sister, and his brother Aaron. And there is a whole lot in this Torah portion that has to do with death. And maybe that is the big connection with the Parah Aduma to begin with. So lots of things in this portion that are difficult. And I'll mention one more up front. I've even seen this terminology employed. It's always kind of, let's just say, like so many other things, it's enigmatic. But you will occasionally see in the Midrash references, and they'll point to this portion as being kind of the place where you see it all come together, references to something that has actually been called the death force. Now, in Exodus, we see the angel, the Malach of death, the avenging angel. But here is a description and kind of an encapsulation of so much about death that it has been said that this Parsha Chukat is the place where we see an understanding of the death force. And whether that's precisely something that I'm willing to go up for or not, I'm not sure, but no doubt about it. Again, this is an enigmatic and a difficult portion, and it kind of goes to the very heart of so much of what the Torah is about, life and death, blessing and cursing. All right, so back to this, the way it begins, with the enigmatic hook of the Parah Aduma. Going to find one of these things, a perfect red heifer, no blemish at all. And literally, the heifer needs to be completely red. Slightly extra scriptural understanding that the sages have come up with and the rabbis enforce, so not that we've had a red heifer for quite a while now, is that this heifer needs to be really, really red. I mean, so red that there aren't any other hairs of any other color at all. Maybe, well, no more than three is the number I've heard quoted, max. And, you know, and a good scare would probably probably bring the red heifer to a place out of spec in that situation. And again, never had a yoke upon her. What's going to happen? You give her unto Eleazar the priest, and she will be brought forth outside the camp and be slain before his face. And at this point, Eleazar the priest will take of her blood with his finger, sprinkles the blood toward the front of the tent of meeting 7 times, and then this heifer will be burned in his sight. Everything about her, her skin, her flesh, her blood, and her dung, all burned. And then the priest takes some cedar wood and some hyssop and some scarlet, and he casts all of that into the midst of the burning of the heifer. Then he washes his clothes and bathes his flesh in water. And afterward, he can come into the camp. But until then, the priest who did this is unclean until evening. Now, here's one of the joke lines, one of the things that people have always kind of scratched their heads and say, you know, when it comes to this red heifer, there are many confusing things, this among them. This red heifer is responsible. It is the key element in making what's called the water of purification. And yet, while that is used to cleanse people from the associations with death, or if you will, the death force, everybody that has anything to do with the creation of this process, the treatment surrounding the red heifer becomes unclean. So, yeah, the old joke is makes clean things unclean, unclean things, even death-associated things, back to being clean. Right, so the priest, after he's done this, he is to wash his clothes in water, bathe his flesh in water, and then he's still unclean until evening, but after that, he's okay. And the man that is clean, now we got another fella at this point, he's clean, at least he starts out that way, he gathers up the ashes of the formerly red heifer, lays them up outside the camp in a clean place. And it shall be kept for the congregation of the B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, for a water of sprinkling. It is, again, for purification from sin. And the fellow that gathers the ashes, well, he too, he becomes unclean. He's unclean till evening. He washes his clothes, and it'll be unto the children of Israel and unto the stranger that sojourns among them. Right? Say it with me. It was done away with, right? Nope. It's a statute forever. He that touches the dead, any man's dead body, will be unclean for 7 days. And he is to purify himself with this water of purification. He does it on the 3rd day, and again on the 7th day. And then after that, he can be clean, but not if he misses. If he doesn't purify himself on the 3rd day and the 7th day, he is not clean. Whosoever touches the dead, the body of a man that's dead, and does not purify himself, he has defiled the tabernacle of Yahuwah. That soul, it says, is to be cut off from Israel because he was not sprinkled and cleaned up with the water of purification. He remains unclean. His uncleanness is still upon him. This, it says, is the instruction, HaTorah, that when a man dies in a tent, everyone that comes into the tent, everything in the tent, is also unclean. So, if you will, one of the things that seems to be associated with this death force is that it's catching. Let me say that again. The death force is catching. And when somebody dies in a tent, everyone that was in there or comes in or all the things that were in there are unclean. Any open vessel that is literally open to the air is unclean. Somebody's out in the open field, and there's a dead body, and they touch the person that's dead. Whether it was somebody that died by the sword or died by himself, you know, just walking through the woods, has a heart attack, and there he is. Or even the bone of a man or of a grave. All of those things, the association with the death force, they too are unclean for 7 days. Something about death, right? For the unclean, they shall take of the ashes of the burning of the purification for sin, and running water shall be poured into a vessel. The clean person takes some hyssop, dips it in the water, sprinkles it upon the things that were made unclean. Here, the tent, and upon him that touched the bone, or the slain, or the dead, or the grave. And the clean person shall sprinkle upon the unclean, again, third day, seventh day. Seventh day he is purified. He washes his clothes, takes a mikvah, bathes himself in water, and at evening, well, he's clean. But if a man fails to do this, he won't purify himself. That soul, again, is to be cut off from the midst of the assembly, because he has defiled the sanctuary of Yahuwah. Water of sprinkling hasn't been put on him. He is unclean. You know, now here is an interesting question, right? Arguably, it's slightly moot, but not really. I think it's certainly interesting to think about, because there are multiple implications here. It's one of those things that makes this a kind of a difficult portion. We don't have a tabernacle. B, we are in exile. So to the extent that these things aren't possible, and it doesn't so much matter that we're walking around in a state of uncleanness, because we're already in exile, we're already cut off from the land anyway, there's not a sanctuary, a tabernacle, a mishkan to go into anyway, and furthermore, hadn't been a red heifer for, I lose track of the time. Yeah, it's been as long as I can remember. Yeah, actually, it's been centuries and centuries and centuries before that. All of this, it says, shall be a perpetual statute unto them. He that sprinkles the water of sprinkling shall wash his clothes. He that touches the water of sprinkling is unclean till evening. And whatsoever the unclean person touches, that too is unclean. This death force is catching. Soul that touches them is unclean until evening. So we have this long discussion of the parah adumah, makes clean things unclean, but it takes and helps and is in indispensable, it seems, in making the unclean things by reason of association with death or something associated with death anyway, helps to make them, it's a vital part of the process to make them clean again. Somehow or other, folks, here's the, here, if you will, is the kind of the enigma of this. We have a red heifer. Maybe it's symbolic of blood. It's also never had a yoke upon it. It's perfect. Now, a lot of folks will say, well, there's certainly elements, parallels, with respect to what was done by Yahushua. But admittedly, there are some things that don't quite match up perfectly. So just to wave your hands and say, oh, that's it, and it's all done. And there's a reference to the Haftorah portion and the Brit Hadashah portion, the portion from the Apostolic Writings. One of those that's popularly read in conjunction with this portion is from Hebrews chapter 9, and it mentions, and we'll talk about this probably some tomorrow, the blood of the red heifer and some of the things that are associated with it. It does say, though, it's a statute forever, and yet it's not a statute that we can do and haven't been able to for a bunch of reasons that we've already mentioned for many, many centuries at this point. All right, chapter 20 is going to take a... Oh, got a question? Did Yah do something with water on the third day? So I'm sure, without looking into it, indeed, the answer I'm sure is yes. And there are so many references to the third day that you'd almost have to sit down and write them all up. But yeah, one of the things that we know from Scripture when it comes to various numbers, the third day and the seventh day are always significant, and they repeat over and over again. Okay, so comment on the screen about how the red heifer is somehow tied to Yeshua and to Adam, maybe first and second, along with Chava, who allowed death to enter the realm. No question about it. But there's more to this, some of which Shlomo would have known. Other parts, obviously, hadn't happened yet. He wouldn't have seen the connections. Nothing, if nothing else, no doubt about it, lots of food for thought. And that takes us to chapter 20, which is also going to have some more connections with death. And let's take a look at this. There's the Benai Israel, the whole congregation, Kol Ha'edah. came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month. And they abode there at Kadesh, and Miriam, it says, died there. And she was buried there. Now, one other comment from verse 1 here. This is kind of a Rashiism having to do with the nature of the Hebrew. Kol ha'edah, right? Even the whole congregation. It sounds a bit redundant, because what it says in the English is, and the B'nai Israel, even kol ha'edah, the whole congregation, came into the... Well, why is it saying that? Says Rashi, what we're being told here in no uncertain terms is that, remember, there were all these folks going to die in the wilderness. Your carcasses will fall in the wilderness. Every man except for the two, Caleb and Joshua, who participated in the first democratic vote and essentially failed to believe Yah rather than the spies, well, their carcasses fell in the wilderness. And so the claim here from Rashi is when it comes to understanding the time frame and what's going on, there are very few people at this point. As a matter of fact, he says none, save the two that we just mentioned, plus Moshe and Aaron and Miriam, who are over the age of 20, that haven't yet died in the wilderness. And at this point, in verse 1, Miriam does. So she was buried there. And Miriam is kind of a key figure over and over again. We see Miriam associated with water in a number of places. And now there is no water for the congregation. So they did what we've gotten used to seeing them do. They grumbled, they murmured, they assembled themselves together against Moshe and against Aaron, and now they just strove with him openly. And they said, have we ever heard this before? Oh, wish we had perished, but that we had perished with our brethren out there before Yahuwah. Why have you brought us and the entire assembly into this wilderness to die here along with ourselves and our cattle? Why did you ever make us come up out of Mitzrayim to bring us into this evil place? They got no seed, no figs, no vines, pomegranates, and now there's not even any water to drink. Wine. How many times, right, have we seen this? So Moshe and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tent of meeting, and what do? They probably are getting used to it at this point when they hear the whining. They fell upon their faces, and the glory of Yahuwah appeared unto them. And at this point, Yahuwah speaks to Moshe, and he says, all right, here's what you're going to do. And by the way, he doesn't say this. You'd think Moshe would have figured it out by now. I'm going to put it in just because it kind of telegraphs where we're headed, right? He should have said, listen real carefully, Moshe. Listen very carefully. This is key. But what he said was just what he wanted done. Take the rod, yours, in other words, assemble the congregation, you and Aaron, your brother, and speak. I'm going to emphasize that again. Speak unto the rock before their eyes that it gives forth its water, its maim. And you will bring forth to them water out of the rock, and thus give the congregation and their cattle water to drink. So Moshe took the rod from before Yahuwah, as he was commanded, and Moshe and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said unto them, listen to this. By the way, here's part of the enigmatic part of the story for so many reasons. Does it have to do with death? Yeah, it really does. Got both Moshe and Aaron and the entire congregation standing there in front of the rock. And he says the following, "Hear now, listen up, basically, you rebels, are we to bring forth water out of this rock?" And what did Moshe do? Did he speak to the rock? Nope. He lifted up his hand and he smote the rock. Well, it worked before. Smote the rock with his rod. Not once. No, that wasn't good enough. But twice. And water came forth in abundance, and the congregation drank, and so did their cattle. And then we get some comeuppance. Yahuwah says unto Moshe and unto Aaron, "Because you didn't believe me, you believed not to set me apart, to sanctify me, to make me Kadesh in the eyes of the B'nai Israel, therefore you will not bring the assembly into the land which I have given them." Now this is a pretty stiff punishment. And in years past, Like so many people, you read this and you go, wait, all the stuff that Moshe's done, and one little mistake. Well, it's actually one really, really big mistake. I like to quote a line that appears more than once in Scripture: to whom much is given, much is expected. Moshe should have known better. In the legal parlance now in America, back when we had a rule of law anyway, they would have said, you knew or should have known. In Moshe's case, he did know, and he certainly should have known. And he knew to listen. But he let a little bit of an outburst here cost him the thing that he's arguably been working up to for his entire life. He is not going to bring the assembly into the land. It says in verse 13, these are the waters of Meribah, where the children of Israel strove with Yahuwah. And Meribah, of course, means strife or contention. And he was ultimately, not originally, but ultimately sanctified in them. Now, there at least appears to end this part of the story. And I see the question on the screen. Yeah, I emphasized it that way on purpose. Because, in fact, that is what Moshe said. And it's part of the reason why I will contend there is joint guilt here. So the question is, did he really say we? And, oh, wait a second, that's capitalized. I'm looking for which. It was Moshe that said we. And it's you got to ask the question, which we is he talking about, right? We, you and me, God, yeah, all right, like the Bill Cosby thing, if those of you that are old enough to remember that. Or I've always kind of thought, well, he meant Aaron and I, we. But anyway, he used the plural, and first person plural, that's the right terminology. It was we. Do we have to bring water forth out of this rock? Arguably not giving credit where it's due. Okay. If there's another question there, I'm not sure that I understand it. So you might want to clarify that. Yeah. What did he say next? That was what he said. That was the only line from Moshe. And then we get the comeuppance. The next one to speak is Yahuwah, who says, because you did not believe me and set me apart, sanctify me in the eyes of the B'nai Israel. And then you guys aren't going to be able to bring them into the land, which I have given them. All right, we get a change of scene and action in verse 14. At this point, Moses sends some messengers from the place where they were, from Kadesh, into the land of Edom. Edom. Interesting. A red. A place of red. Isn't that kind of a consistent theme in this portion? Hmm? Thus says your brother Israel. You know all the stuff that's happened to us, all the travail that has befallen us, how our fathers went down into Egypt, and we dwelt in Egypt or Mitzrayim a really long time, and the Egyptians dwelt ill with us and with our fathers. And then when we cried unto Yahuwah, he heard our voice. He sent a messenger, an angel, and he brought us forth out of Mitzrayim. And behold, here we are. We're hanging out now in Kadesh, city literally on the edge of your border. And he says the following, let us pass, I pray you, through your land. Look, we'll be really careful. We won't pass through your fields or your vineyards, nor will we drink of the water out of your wells. We'll go along the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right hand or to the left until we're done and out of your borders. And Edom responded and said, you will not pass through me, lest I come out with the sword against you. Oops. Children of Israel then said unto him, we'll go up by the highway. If we drink of your water, I and my cattle, this is probably Moshe speaking for them, well, then will I pay for it. We'll give you the price for it. Just let us pass through on our feet. There is no harm done here. Ahem. You will not pass through. And Edom came out against him with much people and with a strong hand. Thus it says Edom refused to give Israel passage through his border, and for that reason Israel turned away from him. And they journeyed from Kadesh, and the children of Israel, even the whole congregation, similar terminology, right? Those that haven't, the ones that are still left, rest of them haven't fallen in the wilderness, came unto Mount Hor. And here, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and Aaron by the border of the land of Edom, and he said the following: Aaron is ready to head home. Aaron is now going to be gathered unto his people, for he also will not enter the land which I have given to the children of Israel, because you rebelled against my word at the waters of Meribah. Notice he's speaking to both of them. So take Aaron, Eleazar his son, bring them up onto Mount Hor. Strip Aaron out of his priestly garments, put him on his son Eleazar, and Aaron will at that point be gathered unto his people. He will die there. So Moshe did, as Yahuwah commanded, and they went up to Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation, Kol Ha'idah. And Moshe stripped Aaron of his garments, he put him on Eleazar his son, and Aaron died there at the top of the mountain. Moshe and Eleazar, just the two of them, came down from the mountain. And when the congregation saw, all of them, that Aaron was dead, they wept for Aaron for 30 days, even all of the house of Israel, Beit Israel. Chapter 21 is going to tell us about a different element of the story. So now we've seen references to the death force, to the things that are done to cleanse people from association with death, the whole story of the red heifer, which literally dies in order to make the ashes of the red heifer and to be able to build the water of purification. And then we see the reason why Aaron and Moshe are both going to die in the wilderness and not be allowed to enter in the land. Then first Miriam passes, then Aaron, and we're going to talk more about Moshe for a while. But essentially, the die is cast on his score as well. And in chapter 21, we hear about a Canaanite, the king of Arad. He dwelt in the south. He heard tell that Israel has come up by way of the Atharim, and he fought against Israel, took some of them captive. And Israel vowed a vow unto Yahuwah, said, look, if you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, I will in fact then utterly destroy their cities. And Yahuwah, it says, hearkened to the call, the voice of Israel, and they delivered up the Canaanites, utterly destroyed them and their cities. And the name of that place was called Hormah. And there they journeyed from Mount Hor, this is a place where Aaron died, remember, by way of the Red Sea, the Sea of Reeds, to compass, to kind of go around the land of Edom. And the soul of the people became impatient, because it was pretty long distance. And they did what? They spoke against Elohim and against Moshe. Ready? Does this sound familiar? Why, oh why, have you brought us up out of Egypt to die here in the wilderness? I got to admit, okay, I can understand why Moshe might have been just a little bit tired of hearing that, and how he let his frustration get the better of him. He should have known better. But ironically, we're still not done, right, with the whining. There's no bread! There's no water! And our soul loathes this contemptible, worthless bread. What? This matzah that has been provided to you through no real effort on your part other than to go out and just pick it up for 40 years here in the wilderness. Our soul loathes this contemptible, worthless bread. Ha kalakal bread. Well, you kind of figure this is not going to go well. And in this case, it is seraphim, fiery serpents, ha seraphim among the people. And it's actually ha nachashim, ha seraphim. Now, nachash, remember, nachash is the same word for the serpent that was there in Genesis chapter 3. Fiery serpents. There's an indication we see here of kind of a copper color to these serpents as well, red or coppery colored. Isn't it interesting? Most everything in this portion has at least some element of red, from Edom to the red heifer to the fiery copper colored seraphim that are nachashim serpents. People came to Moshe And finally they get it. They said, we have sinned because we've spoken against Yahuwah and against you. So please pray to Yahuwah that he takes away these serpents from us. So Moshe did. He prayed for the people. And Yahuwah said unto Moshe, here's what you're going to do. By the way, here is yet another hook, you could argue, that is a little bit enigmatic. What is going on here? One thing that people will remember out of this is what comes out of this story, if nothing else, and now I've forgotten, I should have written it down, the Latin term, somebody can probably remind me online, I'm just drawing a blank for a second here, of the serpent on a pole that is the official symbol of the medical establishment. They got a name for it. And it'll come to me. In any case, that's what we're talking about here. This is where that symbol comes from. What does Yahuwah tell Moshe? He says, make yourself a fiery serpent. Set it up on a pole. And here's what will happen. It'll come to pass that when anyone is bitten, he looks upon it, he sees it, and lives. So Moshe made a serpent of brass. Serpent Nechash Nachashet. Nachashet. Nechash Nachashet. The Hebrew is kind of neat, isn't it? That would be a red-colored serpent made out of kind of a coppery or a red or maybe a little bit of a golden tinge to the red. But a brass serpent puts it up on the pole. It comes to pass that just as had been described, any time the serpent has bitten any man, he looked upon the serpent of brass and he lived. We're going to see later that this serpent of brass becomes an object of idolatry. Children of Israel then journeyed. They pitched in Obot, and they journeyed from Obot. They pitched at a place called Iyeh Abarim in the wilderness, which is in front of Moab, towards the rising of the sun, towards the east. And from there they journeyed, and they pitched in the valley of Zered. So they're making several stops along the way here. From thence they journeyed, pitched on the other side of Arnon, which is still Bamidbar in the wilderness, comes out of the border of the Amorites. This is the border, Arnon, that is, between Moab and the Amorites. Therefore, it is said in the book of the wars of Yahuwah, Vibe in Sufra, and the valleys of Arnon, and the slope of the valleys that incline towards the seat of Ar that leans upon the border of Moab. So we have a description of this place. From there up to Be'er, that's where the well of Yahuwah said, the well whereof Yahuwah said unto Moshe, gather your people together, and I'll give them water. So, Israel sang the following song. Spring up, O well, sing you unto it, the well which the princes digged, which the nobles of the people delved, and the scepter, and with their staves. And from the wilderness to Matanah, from there to Nahaliel, and from Nahaliel to Bamot. From Bamot to the valley that's in the field of Moab, by the top of Pisgah, which looks down upon the desert. After this, Israel sends messengers into a fellow who is going to go down in history legendarily because this is about the end of what he's going to be able to accomplish. Sihon, king of the Amorites, and they said what we've already heard not long ago with respect to people of Edom. Let me pass through your land. We will not turn aside, not into your field or your vineyards. We won't drink of the water out of the wells. We'll just go by the king's highway until we've passed your border. Well, Sihon, kind of same as we've seen before too, he would not suffer Israel to pass through his border, and he did the same thing. He gathered all his people, and they went out against Israel into the wilderness. They came to Yahaz, and they fought against Israel. This turns out to have been a tactical and indeed a strategic error for old Sihon, because that was pretty much it for him. Israel smote him with the edge of the sword, Lefi ha-cherem. And I've made this point before. It's interesting. The mouth of the sword, the edge of the sword. When this terminology is used, we're talking about pagans that are literally smitten. They are smote by the mouth of the sword. Lefi cherem. And Israel then possessed old Sihon and his land from Arnon to the Yabbok, even unto the children of Ammon. For the border of the children of Ammon was strong, and Israel took all of these cities, and they dwelt then in the cities of the Amorites and Heshbon and all the towns thereof. Heshbon was the city, was, of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who'd fought against the former king of Moab, taken all of his land out of his hand, even unto Arnon. So, the parables say, come unto Heshbon, let the city of Sihon be built and established. For a fire has gone out of Heshbon, a flame from the city of Sihon, it devoured Ar of Moab, the lords of the high places of Arnon. Woe unto you, Moab, you're undone, O people of Chemosh. He's given his sons as fugitive, his daughters into captivity, unto Sihon, king of the Amorites. We've shot at them, Heshbon has perished, even unto Dibon. We've laid waste to Nophah, which reaches into Medeba. But that was it for Sihon. And Israel then dwelt in the land of the Amorites. Moshe went to spy out Yazer. They took the towns. They drove out the Amorites that were there. And then they turned. And we're going to set up the next Torah portion with this. They headed up towards the place that's called the Way of Bashan. Got Og, the king of Bashan, not having learned the lesson. Now remember, Og is the big dude. This is a fellow that has the huge bed stand. He's, I forget how many cubits without looking it up again. But he is, he's a lot bigger than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or any NBA ball player, probably by a factor of 2 in height. Not enough, however. He went out, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. Yahuwah now says to Moshe, fear him not. I've already delivered him into your hand, and all of his people, and his land. You're going to do to him just exactly what you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt, past tense, at Heshbon. So they smote him and his sons and all his people until there was none left of him remaining, and they possessed his land too. And the children of Israel, here comes the last verse in the portion, they journeyed, they pitched in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho. Which sets up another story, kind of a major change of pace next week as to what happens when people see what's been going on here and decide they're a little bit unsettled by all of that. So again, that leads us to the end of the portion. Let me just kind of summarize it this way. There's lots and lots and lots of food for thought here. I think we have some additional understanding, no doubt about it, having had the benefit of hindsight and the things that were done by Yahushua. A lot more symbolism has become clear. And yet, in spite of all of that, there are some elements that we say, okay, well, we have a general picture. I don't have a problem with the idea of the general picture. But there are always some little pieces that we just can't quite say we know completely how they fit. I do think, though, that the key here, and I use this terminology, and the more I think about it, the more I kind of like it, there is something associated with the symbolism, with the continuing theme of red that shows up in here. Yes, the life is in the blood. The blood has that characteristic color. We have a red heifer. We have a copper-colored fiery serpent, Nakash, seraphim. We have all kinds of things that essentially say something that has to do with death in a major way is very much central to this Torah portion. And it's also very much central to these commandments, in the form of statutes in this case, a huchat, that have been given to us that should help us to understand and to cleanse and to prepare for life. And kind of on the other side of the coin, right, that's the real opposite.